Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Just as the Missouri Supreme Court was upholding the state's new gun rights amendment, the St. Louis prosecutor and police chief announced plans to push as many gun violence cases as they can toward federal prosecutors. All this as city prosecutor Jennifer Joyce plans to trade her office for an RV. I'm Don Marsh. We'll talk about that with our legal roundtable panelists on today's program and also discuss what may or may not be going on behind the scenes at the U.S. Supreme Court. Is it becoming more liberal? With me in studio, attorneys Bill Freivogel, journalism professor at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. Mark Smith is associate vice chancellor and director of the Career Center at Washington University. And also from Washington University, back with us, law professor Susan Appleton. Thank you all so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Good morning.
Thanks.
I hate to use this term, breaking news, because you hear it for every story on television these days, but this is at least relatively new, and that is that Governor Nixon has issued an executive order basically requiring the state agencies and state people to abide by the Supreme Court decision on same-sex marriage. I thought that was the law of the land. Why do we need an executive order? Can anyone tell me?
Well, because some, I think in Missouri there was one official who said that she didn't agree. It was against her religion and her moral beliefs to do it. So I think, she was just one of many clerks around the country who made that claim. And so I think that's the reason that there needed to be an executive order by the governor saying that the clerks must abide by the law and issue the marriage licenses.
Well, in the meantime, the governor of Kansas, Sam Brownback, has basically said that that his people, the clergy, I guess, and specifically, do not have to abide by that. Susan, what's a contradiction to what the court
No. I think there's a distinction. The Missouri executive order applies to state officials or state agencies, as I understand it, and Governor Brownback was addressing clergy. And I think clergy are free to exercise their religious beliefs and decline to marry couples who, where they feel that they would have a religious objection. Might be right. A mixed religious couple right. That they...
So he really didn't need to do that then. This might just be political.
Yes,
I think definitely, and so the interesting, you know, what I've heard from people, they say, you know, you hear all this press about the Supreme Court saying same-sex marriage is okay, but and people think, okay, so now we have complete equality for gays, you know, and we don't because most states it's still not illegal to discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation, so. While a gay couple could get married, that doesn't mean their employer couldn't fire them, one of them, because they're gay. There are some states that prohibit that, but like, for example, Missouri does not. The city of St. Louis has an amendment that prohibits or a law that prohibits discrimination based on sexual orientation in the city. But so we're, you know, there's a lot of celebration. Well, I think well justified, but. We're not completely there yet.
You're a little bit ahead of me. I wanted to get to that, but let's do that now because this is likely to come back before the court. The gay discrimination is not an over and done with deal. Job discrimination certainly could be brought back before the court.
Right. And the opinion in the marriage equality case did not address what lawyers call the level of scrutiny that applies to discrimination based on sexual orientation. So that would still be very much an open issue. Justice Kennedy found a way to write the opinion that finessed that issue.
Right. Well, Bill, it's a much more liberal court now. I say that with a smile on my face. But that's what a lot of people are writing. And I know you've addressed the subject, too, here for us at St. Louis Public Radio. Is the court more liberal?
Well, I think it's the same court that we had last year and last term and the term before. I don't think it's any more liberal, but certainly what we describe as the more liberal justices on the court won more of the close decisions this year. But that sort of depends upon – it's the mix of cases that are before the court. I think there's been quite a bit of commentary suggesting that one thing was that maybe conservatives overplayed their hand. And so they were able to get four justices to agree to hear a particular case, say the challenge to Obamacare for example, or the challenge to how you prove housing discrimination. But there wasn't the fifth vote to actually get the opinion. So maybe the conservatives overplayed their hand. Next term could be we may at the end of the term with the very same justices find that there's some rather conservative decisions. Affirmative action is coming back before the court. The University of Texas's right. affirmative action plan. So is a challenge to the unionization of state employees from California, and also whether or not we decide how to apportion members of Congress based upon population or based upon voters, which could have a huge, huge difference particularly in states like Texas and California, where there are large Hispanic populations. So next year we could be well saying, "Oh, this conservative Supreme Court." So no, I don't think to answer your question, I don't think the court is any more liberal. Although there were more decisions won by the more liberal justices on the court.
Yes, and the audience can't see Bill using quotation marks in the air. But I think the question turns on what we mean by liberal. And take, for example, Chief Justice Roberts, whose opinions have received a lot of attention. He's conservative in a particular sense of the word, in that in both high-profile cases, marriage equality and the Obamacare case, he deferred to the legislature and thought that judicial restraint was the way to go. And so there would have been a time when we would have called that a conservative result. In the Obamacare case, it got branded as liberal.
Yeah. I think two things I would add. One, just to emphasize what Bill said, your sample size from year to year is so small. You know, most years, Supreme Court's not even taking 100 cases. And probably even people who really watch the Supreme Court are not paying attention to more than 10 or 20 of them. So you got a pretty small group of cases. And I think maybe some folks on the court overplayed their hand in terms of what they were hoping for. The other thing is there's this, you can see in Roberts, I think Susan's exactly right. I mean, he dissents from the gay marriage, but he seems kind of pained. At least that's what I viewed. You know, that he wants to support gay marriage, but he's saying this is not the way to do it. Where Scalia, you know, is much more
emotional
and personal. And personal attacks, which... I mean, he's always been a little bit like that, but it seems like he's just kind of becoming a grouchy old man. He's like that somebody I think I read. So he's like turning into your neighbor who just tells you to get off the lawn. You know, I don't know why he's doing that. It can't help him.
Well, I heard a really interesting interview with Linda Greenhouse, who studies the Supreme Court, who suggested that he's very frustrated because he was meant to lead a conservative revolution on the court, and he's realizing that he's failed.
I think that's very, very possible. I mean, I think it's nothing. I think that probably Justice Scalia was even nastier this year than he has been in the past. But I can remember from the days that I actually sat in the courtroom and covered the U.S. Supreme Court, I remember a decision that was handed down on whether or not graduation prayers could be required at school. There could be prayers at graduation ceremonies at public schools. And Justice Kennedy said no. And I can remember Kennedy reading from the bench and Scalia scowling down the bench at Kennedy and then reading a really nasty dissent. And that's almost 25 years ago. So it's nothing new for Justice Scalia. But I think Susan's right in saying that, I mean, people said when Scalia went on the court that he was such an affable person, that he could lead, he could be the real spark plug of a conservative majority, that he would be like the Justice Brennan for the conservatives. Justice Brennan had been this sort of liberal coalition maker. But Scalia instead, you know, while he's a very affable and funny person, he has this nasty pen and goes after many of the people he needs to make that more conservative majority.
Well, he talked of Justice Kennedy and his opinion profoundly incoherent. He came up with an interpretive jiggery-pokery.
Right.
He accused...
That's like what a third grader says. I mean, it reminds me of that
the
name.
The pure applesauce.
Yeah. You ought to put your head in a bag. I mean, this is like what little kids say. And so I understand being disappointed, and I understand people say things and then you say, well, I kind of wish I hadn't said that. I take it back. But to write it down, to have it reviewed by your clerk, you got to believe. I mean, is there somebody saying,
Some observers have attached great meaning to the fact that instead of saying the usual "I respectfully dissent," he left out "respectfully," mm-hmm. and he in the Obamacare case he just says "I dissent."
Yeah, Nina Totenberg says she really believes that they're very, very happy to get away from each other during this summer recess time, and it sounds like it because they're. And yet
they talk about like how Ginsburg and Scalia are such good friends, and they're out on the road and they do this little show. I mean, I got to believe if people at my work started saying that I should put my head in a bag because of a decision I made, I wouldn't be hanging around with them.
I read that there's a poetry contest based on Justice Scalia's dissents.
Using the words that he uses and stuff?
I want to back up for just a second to the earlier discussion we had on whether the court is turning more liberal. I had read something, and I think this probably pertains to what you were saying, Bill, that being that you don't look at a couple of decisions and say the court is therefore turning liberal. You look at what cases they are deciding to take and to deal with, and there's a profound conservative bent to some of the decisions they've made with regard to, for instance, the Texas abortion case already mentioned. Abortion is coming before the Supreme Court this next term, period.
Well,
I guess probably.
We think so. Yeah. They stayed the order, the mandate below, and I think there were five justices who agreed to stay it, but four who would not have stayed it.
And that would typically suggest that they're going to hear this case, but it doesn't mean absolute.
But they have not done it actually yet.
No, I know they haven't, but don't you think they want to? I think they are probably going to because, I don't think the five justices who probably are the justices who will still recognize an abortion right in the Constitution, the four Democrats plus Kennedy. Mm-hmm. I think the five justices would not have stayed the Texas law.
Which was to keep the clinics open
Their
decision kept the clinics open.
By
that were
staying
about to close.
It, they kept the clinics open. So it was sort of a pro-abortion rights action. Not a decision, but action.
Yes.
I don't think they would have done that if they didn't think that probably down the road they were going to probably address those cases and throw out those provisions of the Texas law. It's bad to predict what the Supreme Court's going to do on stuff like that, but I sort of think that's
I'm not sure I agree with that. And I know this is one of your areas of expertise, but I think you've got to stay it if you're going to decide because you can't once you close these places, you can't reopen them like that. But they've been so comfortable with allowing restrictions, for abortion. And these are, they're making them be more like outpatient facilities like hospitals. Yeah.
Well, rules that Missouri had long before Texas did, mm-hmm. actually.
If the court does take this up, this Texas abortion case, what does that presage for Roe v. Wade? I mean, can Roe v. Wade be tossed out the window if they take this one up?
I suppose it could if there were five justices prepared to overrule Roe versus Wade. My suspicion is that the focus would be on giving a more precise meaning to the undue burden standard, which is the standard post-Roe that has been applied, beginning with the Casey case in, I think, 1992. Mm-hmm. Three justices there said that the test is whether or not the restriction has the purpose or effect of erecting a substantial obstacle in the path of a woman seeking an abortion. And the justices have been in lots of disagreement as to when that threshold is met and when it's not. And the lower courts are also having trouble applying the standard.
And Justice Kennedy is going to be sort of the decider there, mm-hmm. because I think it's pretty clear that the other four Republican appointed justices are going to vote in favor of the Texas law if it does come before them, and that probably the four Democratic appointed justices will vote against, and Kennedy is in the middle. And Kennedy, of course, was one of the joined the sort of famous opinion that decided to keep the abortion right within recognized in the Constitution. Yeah.
There are a couple of other things relating to the Supreme Court's most recent term that I'd like to get to, but we have to take a break. We'll do that now and remind folks that they're listening to the Legal Roundtable discussion here on St. Louis on the Air. My guests in studio, Susan Appleton of Washington University's School of Law, Bill Freivogel, Professor of Journalism at SIU in Carbondale, and Mark Smith, Associate Vice Chancellor at Washington University, where he also directs the Career Center. Back for more discussion in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. We'll continue our Legal Roundtable panel discussion in just a moment. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. The Illinois House is taking another run at a one-month state spending plan when lawmakers return to the Capitol today, a day after a judge ruled that state workers can't be paid if a weeks-long budget standoff persists. St. Louis Republican Jay Ashcroft is beginning a tour of Missouri to promote a proposed constitutional amendment that would require voter identification. Ashcroft is a candidate for Missouri's Secretary of State, and he is pushing the initiative petition for a law requiring voters to present a photo ID at the polls. And an open house will be held later today to give St. Louis residents a chance to see plans to redevelop parts of the city's North Riverfront into public parks, recreation space, businesses, and homes. The Great Rivers Greenway Trails District is spearheading the project and has been studying how to transform the industrial area along the Mississippi River north of downtown. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to the Legal Roundtable panel. Susan, I'll come back to you because you were saying during the break that you've been looking at some of the tea leaves with regard to the same-sex marriage case and see something of interest.
Yes. Well, this pertains to your question about whether or not the court has moved to the left. And I think it's interesting that the concept of liberty the majority embraced in the marriage equality case seems to be one that requires affirmative support from the state. In the past, liberty's been used to keep the state out of one's private life. And here, the petitioners were asking for the state to grant them marriage licenses or to recognize their marriages that were celebrated in other states. And all of the dissenters point that out, that what the court is granting here in the name of liberty is some sort of positive entitlement from the state. And I think that's unusual and worth keeping in mind as we go forward. Justice Kennedy could have avoided the problem by making equality the central concept in his opinion, but that comes in at the end. He really makes it all about liberty and why marriage is a liberty.
You really have to follow every word and every nuance when these justices get together and write their decisions or dissents.
You know, part of the challenge I think they have is, on the one hand, there's not a constitutional thing you can specifically point to. It's tough. And, you know, someone like Roberts is saying, well, let's sit back and wait for the democratic process to work. Because the Supreme Court is kind of anti-democratic. It's, you know, we don't get to vote on those guys. We don't. But what Roberts kind of recognizes, and the majority clearly does, well, that's fine, but that might take 20 or 30 years. And in the meantime, we kind of know where this is going. We know what the right thing is. And some people might quibble with that. And we can't sit back and just let this injustice happen. And I mean, they have to justify it legally, but I always felt like that's kind of where they're coming from. It's just, this is wrong, and we got to find a way to fix this. It's difficult for people to vote the other way.
Another issue that came up that I think caught a lot of people's attention was the Arizona redistricting case, in which the court upheld a voter-approved redistricting commission, which would take the power away from the state legislature. Bill, as the journalist here, you know, what are the national implications of this?
Well, there are commissions in other states, and I think that the folks who want there to be more commissions around the country saw this as a boost for them. I mean, we all know that one of the reasons that we have such polarized Congress is the way in which redistricting and reapportionment is carried out by state legislatures. And the thought is, well, maybe these citizen commissions will be less partisan, and we can begin to get fairer districts that are drawn more fairly. Like Iowa is an example, I believe, a place that where the congressional districts are drawn more fairly. And maybe we can get if we get more fair districts, then maybe we can get a less partisan Congress and one that can actually accomplish something.
And which the primary election is not the election, which is often the case now.
You know, the Republican candidates in particular, it seems to me, and maybe this is true also on the Democratic side, but Republican candidates do all sorts of things because they want to avoid having a challenger on their right, a Tea Party, for lack of a better term, a Tea Party Republican challenging them. And so that causes all sorts of things not to get done in Washington.
Well, it should be pointed out in all fairness that every 10 years, depending on who is in power in a given legislature, they all do the same thing.
Right, absolutely.
Try to enhance their own election potential.
Illinois is a perfect example of that. Yeah. The Democrats are in charge and they apportion things to favor the Democrats. Yeah.
Another issue, we'll just make mention of it, was the lethal injection ruling by the courts. It upheld the use of midazolam in executions in Oklahoma specifically, but that has ramifications here because that's been a big issue here in Missouri as well, Mark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what I found most interesting about that case was the language where the court is putting on the person to be executed the duty to come up with an alternative. And I mean, God, can you imagine? I mean, saying, okay, don't kill me this way, but here's how I'd like to be killed.
Whip me with a feather. Yeah, how about that?
Well, I don't think that would work. Yeah.
No,
I just found that kind of, I don't know, it just seemed, I mean, the whole thing is kind of distasteful. But the idea that you have to propose how you want to be executed.
I think it was very clear at the oral argument that I wasn't there, but I read accounts of it, that that the five conservative justices, more conservative justices on the court, are fed up with the death penalty opponents taking steps outside, you know, taking political steps to cut off the drugs that were the first used for the first part of the three-part cocktail, cut off access to those. You know, then as a result, there's no drug available that is as effective as those drugs that have now been are too scarce to use. And so they're saying, you know, death penalty opponents, you can't cut off access to the safe procedure, and then expect us to say that the death penalty is for that reason cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment.
But they don't call them death penalty opponents; they call them abolitionists. And I thought that was an interesting choice of words. Also in this case, Justice Breyer, joined by Justice Ginsburg, wrote a long dissent explaining why in today's world the capital punishment is cruel and unusual punishment because it happens so unreliably, so arbitrarily, that it's been abolished in a number of states, and so it depends on where you are.
And apparently, again, Justice Scalia behind the scenes was very, very outspoken. From what I've read, I'm not sure exactly what he said, but are any of you familiar with, again, using his colorful language and his own particular style for getting at these things? He apparently was most outspoken.
Well, I mean, the Scalia and the conservatives just think it's ridiculous to say, you know, that the capital punishment is not constitutional the Constitution mentions capital cases. Yeah. So, I can sort of see their point. Although, what Susan points to of Justice Breyer and dissenting opinion saying under all circumstances that capital punishment would be unconstitutional because it can't be applied fairly. I mean it seems like after justices have been on the court for a period of time, they begin to move to that position. Justice Brennan moved to that position, later joined, I believe, by Marshall. Justice Blackmun, who initially supported capital punishment, moved to that position, and now we see Justice Breyer.
And did Stevens maybe?
Stevens too, I think. Yeah.
And just to kind of back up, you know, this is one of the tensions. You know, you've got Scalia, who takes this originalist view of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. When the Constitution was adopted, we were executing people. So Scalia says that's great. And similarly, when we adopted the Constitution or the 14th Amendment, we didn't have gay marriage. So that's the way it should be. We're always that way. Where there other justices take the view, well, no, things change, society changes. The problem with that for someone like Scalia is, well, how do we know where it changes? And that gets him very worked up.
Apparently yeah. It does. Well, let's move away from the Supreme Court for a moment. Another issue that's getting a lot of space in the newspapers and on television and radio these days is the Bill Cosby case. I want to just bring this up because it strikes me as being somewhat odd that the words that he used in a deposition 10 years ago with regard to his having had sex and used Quaalude to affect that and make that happen. It was 10 years ago. It was a deposition. He was never tried and he was never charged. What is that doing in the public domain, Susan?
So I did read the order that the judge issued unsealing, if that's the right word, the deposition. It came in response to a request from the Associated Press. The judge points out that the documents were never ordered sealed in the first place, right, because the case settled. This was a civil case, not a criminal case. And when Bill Cosby invoked the right to privacy to prevent these from being available to the public, this judge said that Bill Cosby's self-appointed role as public moralizer diminishes his entitlement to claim privacy, that because he's been on a soapbox preaching about how people should behave, his own behavior becomes much more available for public scrutiny. And I do think I read that in some states, I think in California now, a criminal investigation is in the works or being...
the statute of limitations has run out in this particular case that
yes,
being referred to. So that's...
But there are many other cases. I saw two alleged victims on TV last night speaking. So I think there might be many other possibilities that would be more timely.
So does this mean overall that if I'm required to make a deposition and there are no charges and there is no trial, that ultimately if someone wants to get at what I said, they can do so?
I don't think so. I mean, in this case, they were, like Susan was saying, they were talking about the fact that he was a public figure. And it wasn't just that he was a public figure because we know him from selling Jell-O pudding pops on TV. It was because of this role he took as a public moralizer. And also, I think part of it, I recall there was mention about him like contradicting the women,
yes,
accusers, and that was important. I think the fact that you're a public figure because people hear you on the radio, that wouldn't be enough to make these things private. And there are other cases where there's been depositions with public figures and, you know, there's purient interest in what was said. That's not enough to make it public.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the judge.
So I think we're safe.
The judge said there wasn't any kind of legal right to get this. That there wasn't. You know, there's no common law right of access to a deposition. But so they said this was. They were just that this argument was on a clean slate. That he had privacy. Rights that he didn't surrender at the courthouse doorstep. But that because of he was not only, as Susan and Mark said, a public figure, but also a public moralizer on these various kinds of topics.
It's kind of the same as with the libel.
He surrendered it.
Kind of the same as with the libel and slander then?
Those are the same. You know, he makes a reference to public official and public figure, mm-hmm, which are the terms of art for the libel law.
The libel law.
But that's one of the things that, you know, mm-hmm, when I teach my little class for the undergrads about law, I always say, you know, when you sue somebody, you know, you should assume you're making your private life public because, you know, pleadings are filed with the court. You can go down. Back in the old days, you would give, when you gave paper copies, you would give two copies, one for the court file and then the other one was the press file. And the press guys would come through and go through and look for interesting cases, and your case might end up on the front page of the Post. That's maybe something you want. Maybe it's not something you want.
Sure, sure. All right, well, we'll move on to yet another subject here now, if we can. I think we're all familiar with the fact that the Missouri Supreme Court upheld two amendments to the state constitution within the last couple of weeks. One is the gun amendment,
and the other is the right to farm amendment. The decision was based on the wording of the thing. But anyway, the amendments were upheld. I found it ironic that the gun amendment was upheld at a time when the chief of police in the city of St. Louis and the city prosecutor, Jennifer Joyce, are trying to establish what they call a nexus between local and federal laws, which can push violent crime cases, gun cases, toward federal prosecution. Your thoughts on that? That seems like maybe we're getting to a slippery slope of some sort where we're kind of manipulating charges to get this before a federal prosecutor, these cases?
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure. I think it's a great idea to be moving a lot of homicide and gun cases into from state into federal court.
I think the federal courts are tougher. That's why they want to
do right, it. Right. But you know, back to the Missouri Supreme Court decision. I thought so as you say, the Missouri Supreme Court said the challenge was that the summary language that the voters were given on what this amendment provided was misleading and because it didn't include some important things, and the Missouri Supreme Court said, well, it wasn't misleading, but you know, in the process of doing that, I thought the most interesting thing about it was they were saying the Missouri Supreme Court the Missouri constitutional amendment on guns doesn't really change give gun users any rights they don't already have under the Second Amendment. Mm-hmm. So they gave what seemed to me to be a rather narrow interpretation of the amendment, saying it didn't really change much or anything. And that opinion then pointed out how Louisiana had passed a number of gun restrictions under a similar kind of amendment, and pointed to language in the U.S. Supreme Court decision that first recognized an individual right to have a gun to protect yourself. Pointed out that decision itself, the Heller decision, had said that you still could have concealed carry laws and regulation of guns in public places. So I read the majority decision of the Missouri Supreme Court as saying this amendment doesn't give gun users any rights that they didn't already have under the Second Amendment. Judge Teitelman very much disagreed in dissent, but he was in dissent. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I read the case the same way that Bill did, that it was a very narrow holding. It was about when a ballot title could be challenged, whether it can be challenged even after the voters have spoken. And I guess the big question is whether or not this interpretation of what the amendment does is binding in future cases and binding on lower courts. Precisely the reason that Judge Teitelman dissented was that he thought that the state constitutional amendment does make important substantive changes and goes well beyond what the federal constitutional right to bear arms has been interpreted to read. And so therefore, he thought that the ballot title was misleading.
Right. So I think the probably the takeaway for your listeners is that this case didn't necessarily say the constitutional amendment was okay. What it was just saying was the ballot, the way it was on the ballot was okay. There's all this other language, and then we were talking about beforehand whether that's really binding or whether it's just what's called dicta, with just judges talking and you pay attention to it, but you're not bound by it. And I think that's still to be determined.
The way it connects, though, with what Jennifer Joyce and the police chief and the U.S. attorney are doing is that what they're doing, sending more of these cases to federal court, is sort of based on the premise that the gun amendment gives all these additional rights, gun rights. So, for example, that based upon that the new amendment would make it impossible to charge a person with a nonviolent felon who has a gun with a crime. And I think if you read the Missouri Supreme Court decision, though we don't know exactly what parts are binding, that they're taking a quite different position.
Yeah. I have some questions about that, but I have to take a break. Let's do that now. Come back and we'll continue this conversation and other subjects as well in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.
And welcome back as we continue our legal roundtable panel discussion with Mark Smith, Bill Freivogel, and Susan Appleton. Mark Smith, I'll come back to you as a former member of the police board with what when they talk about this nexus between local law and federal law. Can you give me a for instance? What would make a case subject to a federal jurisdiction as opposed to local jurisdiction, a gun violence case?
Yeah, so maybe the gun came across interstate lines or something and they could trace that. I don't know. I mean, at the police board, I'm not like prosecuting, arresting criminals. I'm not sure what that would be. But I do think, when we were talking about this during the break, I mean, there may be some other, I don't want to say reasons, but other implications of bringing more federal cases. So one would be you're going to get a different jury pool. And the federal courts, they're drawn from Hannibal down to St. John. And in the city of St. Louis, in a state court action, you're going to be in the city of St. Louis, that jury is going to be very different. So federal courts are probably going to have a wider jury than the city of St. Louis. They're going to have more rural people. That could cut who knows how. Also, Bill was mentioning, and I agree that you get the federal sentencing guidelines. I think oftentimes federal judges are viewed as a little harsher. So there might be some other implications of these kinds of cases going to federal court rather than state.
Does it bother anyone that St. Louis police officers will be looking very, very hard, I would assume, for that connection between federal law and local law?
Well, I guess as an overall, it's not the best way to do things. I mean, yeah. I think that police matters are generally state matters that should be mostly handled in state court. So I think it can be taken too far, and whether or not Jennifer Joyce and the U.S. attorney are doing that, I guess, is debatable. But it seems like they're moving a little bit far out.
Okay, and as we all know by now, Jennifer Joyce is just going to fill out this term and is not going to continue in that longest-serving circuit attorney in St. Louis history. But she is going to continue her work on gun violence cases, she says, and she's very much committed to that, apparently. Any thoughts about her departure?
Well, I always have very much liked Jennifer Joyce. I take her explanation at face value.
Me
she
too.
Was talking about how her parents, who both were members of the Board of Aldermen, I actually covered, I think, her mother at one point when she was a member of the Board of Aldermen. I guess they both died in their 50s. 57, something like that. I think Jennifer is 52, which surprised me, actually. I thought she was younger than that. I think she's been a very hardworking circuit attorney who has generally been on the right side of issues. So I think St. Louis will miss her. Whether she will later on, it seemed like she said in one interview I read that she wasn't ruling out sometime in the future anything at some time in the future.
She's pretty good friends with Catherine Hanaway.
Yeah, they were at Pieper Martin together. They were in the same class, I think.
And there could be something going on there, potentially. We take her, as Bill said, at face value. I don't think we can discount how upset she and her husband were over the demonstration at her home in those in the Ferguson fallout things.
She's
upset
got a
her and
job.
Her neighborhood.
Plus, she's always out at community meetings. I mean, that's a tough job. Not just everything you do is subject to criticism. Everyone loves the armchair quarterback. But then you've got to be out in the community talking to people, and you're going to get blamed for anything that goes wrong. I agree with Bill. I've found Jennifer to be really smart, really hardworking. I always believe what she says. In the past, I've said, people ask something, and I'll say, well, I think they should do this. And I'm wrong. And then Jennifer will call me, but in a very nice way, tell me that I'm wrong. And so I just think she's great. And she's my neighbor. She lives a couple of blocks away. I remember my daughter, who was in eighth grade, had to do a biography about somebody. And she, of course, waits to the day before. And I called Jennifer and I said, I know this. Jennifer meets her at the... So she's now has my you know, 13-year-old's biography of her life. And Jennifer was so nice. And she does that, I think, for everyone. So she's great. It's a real loss, I think.
No truth to the rumor that you had to set up a special phone line for those calls from Jefferson, right?
No.
Another departure is the Chief Justice of the Missouri Supreme Court is stepping down, Mary Russell. But that is to be expected. There's nothing there that we need to read between the lines.
No, it's just routine rotation, I think.
Right. All right. Okay, another thing I wanted to get to, and time is starting to get away, is the Justice Department report on Ferguson, which has been described as a searing indictment of the police and the Ferguson turmoil. I guess that comes as absolutely no surprise to anybody here, given what the Justice Department has been saying throughout. Is anybody surprised? Bill, are you with this?
No. I mean, these seem to be the main criticisms and I guess it's maybe an executive summary that was leaked. The main criticisms seem to be ones that have been voiced broadly, use of dogs, having an officer on top of a vehicle pointing his rifle at the demonstrators during the daytime, making demonstrators continue to walk on the sidewalk and stopping them from saying they couldn't stop. All these things many of these things went to the federal courts and were found to be violations. Violations of the First Amendment, like you have to keep walking, how the tear gas was used. I thought were expected criticisms.
I think they were expected, but I think as I read it, there were also broader criticisms just about bad community relations mm-hmm. on the part of the police.
So what happens now? The Justice Department has its searing indictment. It's up to the community to change. I guess the Justice Department can't make things happen, or can it?
Well, I think I read that the police officials were going to be meeting with the Justice Department officials to go over the report in more detail. I guess I do expect there to mm-hmm. be a response on the part of the police officials in St. Louis.
I remember when I was on the police board, we had some issues, and we brought in somebody from the Justice Department to talk to us. And I mean, we took very seriously what they said, and they have resources and they have ideas, and you know, they can help. So I would think people would take this very seriously and try and do their best. I also seem to remember Steve Sanger talking about trying to make it easier for the police departments in the county, not the county police, but these individuals to merge in together. I mean, I think that's one of the real issues, is you got all these little independent fiefdoms, and if we can bring those together, it's easier to control one or two departments and raise standards.
Right. We have a couple of calls. Time is getting away. I'll take one from Bill calling from St. Louis. He wants to go back to Justice Scalia, I believe. Bill, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. What a great show, as always. Two comments. First, I welcome the opportunity to say that Scalia is the dumbest smart person ever. He hasn't been right on a major issue in his whole life. He reasons by deciding what he's going to conclude and reasoning backwards, and Supreme Court justice should enroll that way. Now, on abortion, I'm not an abortion scholar, but as I probably mentioned, I had Archibald Cox, the former Solicitor General for Constitutional Law, in law school, so that's a good start. And on abortion, I've always thought that economic status is not a fundamental right in some ways in the Constitution, but some rights are related to it. And for middle-class women to be able to get abortions by flying to New York like they used to or whatever, and poor women to have to go to back alley abortionists or whatever, that must have violated some constitutional principles. And I would have rather seen the original case lay on that sort of grounds. And I was wondering if your scholars knew of any literature that argued that that bias built in might be grounds for.
Let's ask them.
Yes. So actually, there are scholars today doing research on that issue in connection with the 50th anniversary of Griswold versus Connecticut, which was the case about the right of married couples to use birth control that started this chain of right to privacy cases. And one particular scholar, Carrie Franklin at the University of Texas, is writing about how Griswold really should be seen as public law because it was an intervention designed to help poor women. The Supreme Court did decide that even if there is a right to abortion, there is no right to a state or federally funded abortion. The Hyde Amendment is constitutional, and even if that means that poor women cannot have access. But I think it's also true that that holding unfolds against a background where abortions were available, where clinics were open, where you could get to a clinic, where a nonprofit might provide abortion services. And with these current efforts to defund Planned Parenthood, I read in the paper this morning that some House members are trying to defund the Title X program to birth control. Some of the assumptions that were made by the court when it was held that there is no right to state subsidies of these privacy rights could be very much in question. So I agree with the caller that economic status isn't considered a suspect class, mm-hmm. but I do think certain assumptions that led to that are starting to unravel.
In defense of Justice Scalia, which I don't think I've ever done before, Justice Scalia was the fifth vote to say that burning the American flag was protected by the First Amendment. This term, he wrote the opinion that said Abercrombie and Fitch couldn't basically refuse to hire a woman for who wore a headscarf. So maybe even from the caller's point of view, every once in a while, he's on the right side.
And I would just say, first of all, I had Archibald Cox for con law when I was in college. And what a snooze he was. So I hope he's not. God, I was so excited about it. But the abortion thing, I mean, I think the way, you know, there's two things that could happen, or at least two things to restrict the abortion rights. One would be to overturn Roe versus Wade. I don't see that happening. But I think just saying these are not an undue restriction, and you kind of chip away, and it gets a little press, but it doesn't get a huge amount of press. That's kind of what's been happening with the conservatives on the Supreme Court over the last 20 years, and I think that'll probably happen next year.
That's it. Yeah, and so even in the Texas case that we've been talking about, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals held that most of the clinics could close without imposing undue burdens to women, but that certain clinics had to stay open because they were otherwise women would have to drive over 250 miles. Right. So it's very imprecise what constitutes an undue burden, how much of an obstacle is required for it to be significant and therefore unconstitutional.
And there were some kind of weird exceptions. I haven't read that case. I talked about it in the spring, but there were some weird exceptions too. So it doesn't make a lot of sense. It's not like a good kind of constitutional rule where you can say, now I know what to do, you know.
In the 2 minutes we have left, just one other issue I wanted to raise, and that concerns the issue of the Confederate flag. We've been reading and hearing about that, what's going on in the South. But there are also some spinoff here in St. Louis, where we have some at least one monument and some other names that people are talking about. You know, maybe changes need to be made there. Are there legal issues here that we should be considering with regard to moving a 32-foot-tall monument out of Forest Park?
I think they're policy issues more than probably legal issues. And I read an interesting piece this morning that suggested that if we try to get rid of memorials as distinguished from flags, battle flags, that there's, and I'm quoting from this editorial I read, there's a danger we'll forget the connections of past racial crimes to current racial inequality, that some of these monuments can have teaching value about what was wrong with the past. And so we have to take that into account. So I don't see a legal issue there. I don't know if my colleagues here do.
No, I agree. I agree with that. I think it's up to the political branches of government to decide whether to take down these Confederate battle flags. I think my own opinion is that they should. That the Confederate battle flag is to slavery what the swastika is to the Holocaust, and should be taken down. But you know, there was a Supreme Court decision on this that said Texas could decide not to provide a license plate that with a Confederate flag on it. Mm-hmm. So certainly the government has the power when it is speaking to say, we don't want the Confederate flag. I suppose they have the power to also say, we want the Confederate flag.
The only two legal issues I see is, you know, there's been some vandalism of some of these places, and I think there are arguments, well, it's not really vandalism, but I think the law is going to say it is vandalism. Mm-hmm. And so if you got caught. The other one is, you know, a lot of colleges have buildings named after, and there's mm-hmm. been a move to change that, but the donors may have restricted the money, so that may be problematic.
We'll be here. We have to end it at that point. Our friend Eddie Roth, by the way, will be determining what happens to that monument in Forest Park.
Yeah,
he's been commissioned to do that from Mayor Slay. I want to thank you all so much for being with us today. Another fast hour. Mark Smith, good to see you. Welcome home
after
a vacation.
Sure.
Susan Appleton, always nice to see you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Bill Freivogel, good to have you with us as well. And we'll be back tomorrow, and at that time on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the role of the African-American church and an effort to help rebuild Southern black churches that were recently destroyed by arson. We'll also take a look at issues caused by continued rain in this area, including flooding of area rivers. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.